Hi, this is Jennifer Sage with the Indoor Cycling Association, and I'm here with my favorite cyclist, Tom Scotto. How are you, Tom?
Jennifer, I'm doing great, thanks.
Well, always good to talk with you. Today, we're going to talk about outdoor training and technique that we don't really recommend for indoor use.
No.
We always talk about keep it real and how it's important to train indoors like we would outdoors, but there are some things that, you know, elite cyclists do, that very strong cyclists do, and that the mechanics of an outdoor bike allow you that indoors it doesn't.
Right.
Tell us real briefly about your cycling experience. I know most people listening to this know you, but, you know, I want them to realize that this comes from the voice of experience.
Yeah, and like the voice of experience, most of it has been through trying experiences. Challenging nature, yeah. Which is how you learn most of your best stuff. But no, I've been competitive regionally here probably for the last 20 years, mostly masters level racing. And, you know, I think the great thing about even racing in the master level, I mean, you learn something in every level. I mean, when I was, you know, at the lower levels or the entry levels, I should say, you know, there was a whole different learning curve. Most of it was just trying to survive because the early races are sort of like people tying squirrels together at the tails and letting them go on the course. That's kind of the best way to describe it. But, you know, when you get into the master level racing, which is really an age bracket, so, you know, at once you could say, well, you know, you would think it would be easier, you know, when you get up, you know, 35, 45, 55, 65 years old. But in general, you're dealing with riders who have a tremendous amount of experience and muscle memory. So, you know, a lot of these things that we're going to talk about, you know, it would be easy for them to be able to pull this stuff off on the road and in their training, but, you know, it would not be something that we would advise either mechanically or from an exertion standpoint or a safety standpoint in indoors.
And then you also coach riders, correct?
Yes.
And you coach a team?
Yeah, one of the local teams here. And the riders I coach, people always think I only coach pro-level riders. Because that's usually what people ask me. They're like, oh, I'd love you to coach me, but I'm, you know, I'm just doing a charity ride and you'd probably coach pros. So for the record, I coach riders of all levels and nothing against the pros. I love you guys, but usually you're pretty stubborn and I'd rather coach beginners.
Yeah.
The beginners listen, you know.
And they're there for, I mean, they're just, I love working with newbies.
Yeah, well, you see their growth and yeah. How they improve and they're like sponges and, you know, the pros, you have to fight them on everything because you're dealing with years of, this is how I've done it. So, yeah.
So indoors we have cadence ranges and they're predominantly for, because we're working with a vast majority of people in indoor cycling are not generally cyclists or they're just, you know, sort of weekend riders. So the cadence ranges that we use indoors are for most intents and purposes, 60 to 80-ish, 85 for climbing, and then 70, 75-ish to up to 100, 110 for flat road work. I know both you and I have done profiles where we go slower than 60 and a little bit faster than 110, especially you. But those are for the, you know, the exceptions. Generally, it's 60 to 80. But a cyclist might train a little faster. Let's talk about neuromuscular development. What does a cyclist do to train their neuromuscular development?
Well, it goes in a couple of steps, just like developing anything. You know, first thing we're doing is we're trying to generate some speed for the muscle to function. So we're trying to get the nervous system, you know, as you stated, neuromuscular development. We want the nervous system to start responding faster. And that only happens through training. And in order to do that, we have to pedal faster so that the requirements are, you know, are greater. And then as we develop the speed of the signal, we need to develop the strength of the signal so that there's more muscle activation happening. And that happens where we add not just the speed, but we also start adding resistance or stress.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, the caution that you and I will always throw out there is just because we're just going to start with speed doesn't mean we pedal without resistance.
Right.
You know, we're always in control. We're never riding without resistance because then your muscles aren't activating at all. It's really your joints that are doing the work, and you usually don't want your joints doing that kind of work.
Exactly.
On their own, unsupported by the muscles.
Muscles and ligaments and all the everything that keeps the joint, the integrity of the joint. But you might read a training. I have Dirk Friel's little training, a little workbook, and there are workouts in there with cadences up to 130, 140. And they're valid for a cyclist who already has the technique and the skill, because pedaling that fast is really hard to do.
It is. It is, and it requires not just the speed and the neuromuscular activation of the legs. It also requires the opposite, the relaxation,
uh-huh,
and postural relaxation of the upper body. And you will see a rider trying to attempt. I mean, even myself. Anytime I'm pushing myself up beyond my normal leg speed or my adaptive leg speed, I have to start focusing more on relaxation and more on mechanics. But you start bouncing in the saddle, you start losing, contact. You can feel the awkwardness in your pedal stroke. So it happens to everybody. It depends on what your where your stress point is. Where you're pushing outside of your the range that you're used to controlling.
I think I read once in a Joe Friel on his blog when he was talking about leg speed training, and he told cyclists to train, and this is indoor training, where their bike's on a trainer, to pedal as fast as they could until they reached what he called the bounce threshold. And then once you start bouncing, to back it off a little bit. And depending on one's skill, that might be 95, it might be 105, it might be 120, it might be 130. So if you can pedal that fast without bouncing, good. You're training. You're trying to lift up that bounce threshold, and thus increase your technique. Indoors, the vast majority of our students really are unable to develop the skill needed to be able to do that and benefit from it. This is why we don't recommend. This is one of the reasons why we don't recommend doing it indoors.
Well, there's also the mechanical factor of the bike.
Exactly.
Which is one of the reasons why we do recommend limits on speed, because when you're pedaling really fast, and a lot of times we don't even recommend this on a outdoor bike in a trainer, because it doesn't move and it also puts a lot of stress on the frame.
Right.
But if you're track cyclists are notorious for pedaling 140 plus.
Right, RPM. But they've got legs like tree trunks. I mean, they're not
right. And they're, and of course they've spent a lot of time doing neuromuscular work. But you're going to work within the mechanics of the bike, and if the bike is not going to move normally under the forces that you're applying while you're pedaling, the body will take that stress.
Right.
And it's not the good stress. We do want to stress our bodies appropriately, but right, that is not the good stress. That's opposing forces against the joints.
Yes. So pedaling that fast rattles the bike, and it rattles your body.
And your brain probably too.
And your brain probably. And then there's the fact that the flywheel, when you get it going, especially if you're training with, high cadence, lower resistance. Remember, I always point out that low resistance does not mean no resistance. But there's some assistance by that flywheel. So it's going to be a little less beneficial indoors than it might be for someone on a regular road bike training leg speed.
Absolutely. And the other piece in there, just to throw the full picture is, when you're on your road bike as an outdoor cyclist, one would hope, it's not a guarantee, but one would hope that you're actually fit properly to that bike.
Yes.
That guarantee is not always available to you indoors, because you might be close.
Yeah.
Although you and I, I'm sure, have witnessed many people that are not close, and then they're trying to apply that type of speed and that type of mechanical movement to forces that are not, not conducive to developing mm-hmm. speed. And probably more conducive to a free trip to the hospital.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. So we stick by our cadence ranges for those reasons. And anything outside of them are the exception, not the norm. Like, maybe down to 55 on the low end and you take them up to 120. I usually use 110 as my ceiling, but anything faster than is truly, truly the exception, with a group that is well-trained, who you know their abilities. They've been training with you a long time. You train properly. That is the only time that we suggest that you go outside of those ranges, correct?
Correct. That's the judgment call of a good instructor.
Yes.
They will look at their demographic. You know, if they're teaching a special class or something where they know they have a majority of, you know, riders that can meet that additional criteria, or they've been very good at training their people and giving options. I mean, there's nothing wrong with pushing a subset of your class
yeah.
if you're very good at giving options for
okay.
those that can't handle it. Because even 110 for some people is tough.
Oh, yeah.
Not everybody can pedal at 110, even though it's a safe upper limit.
Uh-huh.
So we don't want to make them feel bad that they can't get there.
Yep. Okay. Let's talk about the other end of the spectrum. You know, pedaling at higher resistance and slower cadences, this presents a different kind of a risk. It's not the kind of jostling and jarring of the joints. It's just excessive strain. And anyone listening to this has probably pulled a muscle at some point in their life. And if you look at, you know, the mechanism of that injury, what led to it, it usually means doing something that you weren't prepared for. You bent down to
Correct.
Pick something up and you pull a muscle in your back and you weren't prepared for it either, you know, anatomically, alignment wise, and or your strength. So what do cyclists do on the lower end, and why might we want to not do that indoors?
Well, as far as getting into loads that would simulate muscular strength development, there's the process, just like we talked about neuromuscular development. You don't jump into heavy, you know, overloaded strength training.
Yeah.
You know, you have to actually do the speed work first so you can develop some conditioning in the ligaments and the tendons and the joint function, and then you can start increasing stress. So, you know, you might start out with doing more muscular endurance work where it's moderate stress on the muscles for longer periods of time until you work to the point of, you know, doing some slower cadences with, you know, heavy to overloaded amounts of training stress, but for very short periods of time.
And when you say
if you're
short,
holding it for a long time, you're doing muscular endurance again.
If it's short, then you're talking 1 or 2 minutes, right?
Yeah, 2 minutes is really the push in the max. I mean, honestly, if you're truly doing strength work, I mean, you're talking 30 seconds to a minute.
Uh-huh.
But again, it depends on who you're conditioning. You know, if your class are not elite level athletes, you're probably going to want to work them down from the longer muscular endurance efforts to a strength training or strength focused effort.
So in this past year's winter training program, when I came out and did my session, I did the strength development segment, and I took them down to, I think the slowest I went was 57 RPM, and I think I had 2 to 3 minute segments. And that was hard. It is really hard to pedal that slow. But tell me what some of your cyclists do when you're training this and what you would not recommend indoors. How low do you go outdoors?
I mean, we've gone as low as 40.
Uh-huh.
However, you know, what comes into play when you're pushing at 40 RPM for a reason. Like, the reason we're at 40 RPM is because we can't go any faster.
Yeah.
And on a bike, we also don't have a resistance knob, and we basically run out of gears. So, you know, it's like, okay, either I get off my bike and walk, or I try to keep the bike moving forward.
So you're talking about somehow. A 20% grade, perhaps.
Right, yeah, probably somewhere upwards of 12, 14, up to 20 plus.
Yeah, and
but the critical piece there is, number one, the bike moves.
Yeah,
because you're putting a tremendous amount of forces, you know, onto the frame, and you have to maintain good form.
Yes,
and that is probably the biggest violation that we've probably both seen
indoors
is that people start loading on the resistance, and all of a sudden you see upper body, you know. Gymnastics and convulsions.
And pulling on the handlebars. Anytime you have to just pull and contrive the upper body, you are putting yourself at risk indoors.
Right. I mean, I've seen classes where everyone looks like they're more wrestling alligators than they are riding bikes.
So do not do this indoors. you know, unless you're training in a group of elite athletes, even then, this is probably something you should do outdoors because of the fact that the bike does move outdoors. And stick with the cadence range for the general population, 60 for your more trained, strong, the ones who have done a periodized program and who have gradually and progressively got to this point, perhaps down to what, 55?
Yeah, 50, 55, I think it's still a safe range for a static bike.
Yeah, yeah.
When you start getting below that, you're better off being on a bike that moves.
Yes. But again, we're talking about things we do not recommend indoors. We just don't want to ignore the fact and or pretend that cyclists don't do this outdoors.
Right. And I think this line to what we're both saying during this interview is that we're trying to get away from the extremes where, you know, a cycling instructor will say, this is never done. I mean, the whole point of us saying this is like, these are valid training techniques. They're just not advised for the reasons that we're giving you to be used for indoor purposes.
Yep. And I hear it all the time from good, well-meaning instructors who say, oh, no, this is never done. One of those things is one-legged pedaling. Okay, they, meaning cyclists, do train with one leg at a time. They'll put their bike on a trainer, but the difference, Tom, is what? They bring in a milk crate or a stool or something.
Yeah, we usually have, you know, two milk crates or, you know, two chairs or stools or something, you know, one on each side of the bike so we can, you know, unclip and work on one leg at a time. And the reason for that is to be able to maintain good posture. Because if you unclip a foot, you know, to work on one and you're like putting it up on the center, you know, beam of the bike, or I've seen people reach far back and put their foot on the back pad.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, whatever. They're just trying to get it out of the way, or they just dangle it out to the side. You've now changed the angle and alignment of the hips. So you're not training the joint how it would normally work. And a lot of times you're not even training it in a functionally effective way that it would actually be used while you're riding.
Yeah. So the benefit is getting lost. And back to that free will, there's some assistance in the free will as well. So you're probably not getting what you think you came for.
Right. And there's the danger, of course, you know, if you're dangling your foot out to the side, that you're going to get whacked by the pedal going around. And people don't realize that if you don't have a place to put your foot that maintains good posture, your spine, particularly the lower spine and the hip complex, is going to compensate for that.
Yes.
It's going to tighten up. It's going to try to stabilize. And again, you're wasting your function. You're wasting your time on the bike doing that.
You know, you just talked about you might risk having your leg sliced open by a moving pedal. Always remember that there's no coasting indoors. So that pedal's not going to stop. Outdoors or on a road bike, an outdoor road bike that is on a trainer, if by chance you got hit by the pedal, it's a free will. It'll stop. It might bruise you, but it's not going to slice you open. We had an instructor when we very first got our spin bikes 18 years ago at the club that I worked at, you know, shortly after spinning came out. And one of the instructors, her foot came out and the pedal sliced a gash in the back of her calf. She had to get 18 stitches.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was one of my first experiences to the risks. And she's a cyclist. It just, you know, for whatever reason, just her foot came out.
Yep, that's why they call them accidents, right?
Yes. Okay, something that cyclists do to train explosive power. Now, you are the king of explosive power. We've done some profiles on ICA that really go into explosive power and how to train it. But still, it is not the same level of training that you would do outdoors. Because if you did that indoors, you would kill your students. And, you know, give a description of these. I've heard them called stomps. You call them standing starts or jumps. But they,
sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think the king reference, you know, I love explosive power. I'm not sure if I'm the king of explosive power. Matter of fact, I'm pretty confident I'm not.
Maybe not in your outdoor group, but in the cycling, indoor cycling world, yes.
I think I'm probably most known for that, if anything else.
But, yeah.
We have a technique, and again, it's to activate maximum neurological activation. We're trying to get as much muscle function and much power as possible as quickly as possible. And one of the techniques we use, we call them jumps. They're usually done from a standing start. you would load, and this would violate, this goes all through the violation of our last topic, which was slow cadences. You would pretty much put it in the biggest or hardest gear possible with your legs stopped. And then within about 10, no more than 15, 20 seconds, you try to move the pedals and slowly bring them to the point where you can overcome the resistance. It's brutality to the max.
Do you think that an indoor bike, the cranks and the bottom bracket are strong enough to withstand that if you had a heavy person on?
Oh, absolutely. Those things are just so overbuilt compared to a real bike.
So it's not a component issue. It's so hard on the body to overcome that much resistance.
But yeah, it's the resistance, it's the joint stress, and the posture, the form. If you're not in good form and you're trying to overcome that amount of stress on the muscle, you're gonna hurt yourself.
Yep. So, very valid for outdoor, for racers, for people who are trying to develop that explosive power to really, really blast past a group or win a stage or for whatever reason. Indoors, there's no reason. The risk is way too high. Don't do them.
Right. And of course, I mean, that's, my thing about jumps is, to me, in our world, those are jumps.
Yeah.
Because you're really jumping from a start, from a standstill to your maximum effort. And they're very, very difficult, even though they're only 15, 20 seconds max, that you do, a half a dozen of those and you're going home.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just imagine I'd probably be able to only do one or two right now in my current state. Well, actually, they wouldn't be valid for me because I've lost my fitness due to my time off. So these are only things you would do with someone who has progressed to that point.
Exactly.
All right. One of the big things, one of the very obvious things is we're working with a bike that doesn't move. And even if you have a bike that does rock side to side, real rider, we're talking about the kind of movement that, like turning a corner, not just leaning a little bit, but most of the bikes do not move. So therefore, bike handling skills are obviously very, very important for outdoors, for both road and mountain, but they're irrelevant indoors. You can't train for that indoors. Have you ever been to a class heard of a class where the instructor says, okay, we're turning left, and everyone leans to the left? Not just leaning, again, on the real rider, but imagine a static bike, and their whole bodies go to the left. And now we're turning right, and they go right. What a strain on the body.
Well, yeah, because the bike's not going anywhere, so all you're doing is contorting the spine and the hips and everything else to simulate something that's not really happening.
Exactly. Like you had said earlier, people tend to do these silly things, these concepts that, of course, we do outside, but you can't pretend. You can't fake a turn.
I would say the only exception, and we're not really faking, it's more of a visualization tool, is I love when I'm on a long climb and, we're simulating multiple switchbacks.
Oh, I love that. I love it.
You have them, coming up out of the saddle, you explain the concept of the switchback. And then sometimes I'll have them imagine looking, if we're doing a left-handed turn, the guardrail's on the right. And, I have them look down over the valley, and see where we're coming from. But again, we're not doing anything with the body that, would be trying to simulate the bike turning or anything like that.
Visuals, fine. Now, I went on a mountain bike ride the other day, and where I live, we have quite a bit of single track, and it's undulating up and down. There's some steep downhill sections, and as I was going down fairly quickly, I have sagebrush on either side, so it's pretty narrow, so you have to maneuver the bike, especially as it's turning, as I'm going downhill, and there's rocks. I had to push my butt back over the saddle so I wouldn't go over the handlebars. I was hovering. I was doing this hover that is absolutely essential outdoors because I don't want to, bite the dirt. So, but the difference is I wasn't pedaling. I would sometimes have my right foot in front and then shift, after a couple, 10, 15 seconds and put my left foot in front just to kind of change the balance. But hovering has its purpose outdoors, It never does indoors. Once you start having that consistent cadence, consistent pedaling motion, all you're doing, kind of similar to the, you know, everything we just talked about, you're just throwing your body out of its mechanically efficient position to apply force to the pedal.
Exactly, because all you're doing is you're forcing muscle engagement. So you're coming up out of the saddle, you're trying to stabilize your body out of the saddle, and then you're asking your body to pedal with muscles that are now trying to stabilize something that's totally different.
Yeah, and it hurts. You know, when I've tried this indoors, it hurts my knees and it hurts my back. So I don't understand why people think there's a benefit indoors. They say they claim that they're engaging the hamstrings.
Yeah. Well, that's I doubt that. I mean,
yeah.
One other thing that is interesting, which it proves its ineffectiveness, is when I'm out on the road, and I did this on Saturday with the group ride I was out training with, there was a woman that was trying to stand. And every time she stood on the bike to go up a small hill, she wouldn't move the bike at all. So essentially, she was doing a hover because she wasn't coming off of her – she was coming off of her seat, but she wasn't moving forward. And I could see she was struggling. She would start to come up out of the saddle, and she couldn't do it. She'd sat back down, and the group would disappear, you know, over the top, and then she'd have to catch back up. So I went and worked with her on how to get her butt away from the seat so that it can actually move back and forth, and, you know, some gearing tips, and eventually she was able to do that. But her complaint was that it put so much stress on her upper body the way, and her lower back when she was trying to do it the first way.
Yeah.
So in real cycling, it sort of proves the fact that you probably shouldn't be doing that indoors, period.
Exactly. Now, I was just talking about going down and having to push my butt back. Well, when a cyclist is going up a steep hill, when your front wheel is quite a bit higher than your back wheel, your body mechanics change. So what do you do outdoors?
Well, outdoors, you're going to find whatever the center of gravity is on your bike based on the level of pitch or the grade, which of course, you know, we can't do that indoors unless I think you and I talked about this, you know, when I grew up in New York City, one of the great benefits of living in New York City and training on a bike, on a trainer, is that if you want to put something under the front wheel to make the front wheel higher to simulate like climbing, New York City had the biggest yellow pages I've ever seen in my life. So I would go down the street, like knock on my neighbor's door. I'm like, do you need your yellow pages? And they didn't know what, you know, they're like, what is this guy doing? And I would stack them up, you know, depending on the, like, two or three yellow pages, you know, that you'd be climbing a pretty good mountain. But
so you're changing the angle of the bike just like you would outdoors. Instructors who try to simulate this indoors say, hey, we're going up a steep climb, throw your hips forward. It's not doing you any good.
Well, not only that, with the thing that people tend to miss on a bike in general is that if you're doing a squat in a squat rack or a Smith machine or whatever you're doing for your squats, you're applying force in one direction, and it's a very straight linear force. On a bike, it's shear forces. You're not pushing straight down. That pedal is moving in a circular movement, so your forces are displaced.
Mm-hmm.
If you shift your body weight back, you've now changed all those angles, the knee angle, the hip angle, the angle at your ankle, and now they're trying to deal with forces that are pushing against your joints in all the wrong movements, in all the wrong alignment.
Yeah.
And it's very dangerous. I mean, particularly if you have a fixed wheel, you know, to add insult to injury, that's not going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
If your joints are, you know, found themselves in a very precarious position.
Now, we're not advocating no change in fore and aft of your hips. We're just advocating keeping it a little more a narrower range, a couple inches forward, a couple inches back. Because I've noticed, you know, if I'm going to put on a heavier gear and maybe power out of the saddle, I might move forward a little bit, like a half an inch. But it makes a difference. Indoors. Again, outdoors, the bike would move underneath me as the hill rised and as the hill rose and tip itself angle upward. So my position relative to the stem, for example, would be closer.
Right, and that's a product of both the angle of the bike and the forces that you're applying. And I think if we were to analyze that, like, you know, giving someone the visual of coming up out of the saddle and climbing, and it's not a steep climb, and maybe they're not being aggressive, they're just, you know, like enjoying a very relaxed muscular endurance climb, their upper body is not very aggressive. And then we might say, okay, now we're going to come up out of the saddle and we're going to attack or we're going to sprint. And then all of a sudden they have a sharper angle at the pelvis. They're effectively going to be in a different position, but all the joints have compensated for that. It's different than just taking your whole body and leaning it back.
Uh-huh.
Like you get aggressive, your knee angles change, your everything changes to be able to deliver the force at the optimal angle. And that's a natural thing that the body does if you allow it to. If you start forcing the body to go all the way forward, all the way back, now you're artificially doing that, and the joints don't have the same sort of proprioceptive control to say, oh, I know what's going on here. He wants a lot of force. I better put myself in the best position possible. We're almost forcing people to go into a wrong position.
So just in closing, always remember that there are some very valid training techniques that elite, and not just elite, but cyclists who have trained properly, they could be recreational cyclists, but who have gone through a periodized program and who have done this in a gradual, progressive manner, and also who have quite a few years, perhaps, of doing this. These valid training methods should remain outdoors. What we do indoors, we want to try to keep safe and effective for all of our students, not just a, you know, very fringe elite group.
Right, and I think that's the thing we always have to keep in mind, because we are essentially group fitness instructors. And with that being said, is we have a wide demographic, and we are responsible for the safety and the effectiveness of the training of everybody in that room. And you know, I've said this many times, if you're doing something that's hard enough where you have to monitor form that closely, and you have 15, 20, 30 people in the room, and you can't monitor everyone to do it properly, you shouldn't be doing it. So, and I think not everything, but some of the things that we just talked about fall into that category.
And I'll also close by saying, by reminding everyone, you know, as skilled as Tom is in his training and how he trains his students, you also have very few cyclists in your class. You are training them like cyclists, not some of these techniques we just talked about, but most of them don't ride bikes. So you can still, it's not always valid to say, well, my students aren't cyclists, so I don't need to focus on proper, you know, these cycling techniques.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you've been to my classes, and I think that's a misnomer most people have. Oh, well, Tom, yeah, it's easy for him. He's got all these pros in his class. No, I've got like 3 or 4 cyclists out of a group of 30. So I'm pretty much in the same boat as everybody else.
Well, great, Tom. This is awesome information. I'd like to talk to you again on another occasion on some of the creative licenses that we do take indoors.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
You know, we take some valid training techniques, and because it is a group fitness class, kind of throw in, obviously, you know, the element of music and perhaps rhythm. So, well, thanks again.
And you're very welcome.
I look forward to chatting with you again.
Awesome, Jennifer. Always a pleasure.